They have been fighting the Israeli regime in different ways. They are courageous people. They have made great progress by carrying out direct and concrete actions against the Israeli regime. This terrorist regime accuses the people of Jenin of being terrorists and therefore invades the city. But when we talk about terrorism, we have to talk about the Zionist state, which has a totally arbitrary detention system, and Palestinians may face indefinite detention. Since 2015, Israeli regime has withheld the remains of the 132 Palestinians and hasn't handed them over to their families. Israel has already kept 500 corpses of Palestinians. This is the terrorist state. Palestinian families don't have the opportunity to bid farewell to their beloved ones. This is the terrorist Zionist regime. The problem is that Israel is presented internationally as a guarantor of peace, which is a fallacy. The Zionist regime has inflamed conflicts and adversity in West Asia. Many religious and non-religious revolutionary leaders in the world believe in the defense of the Palestinian state, the Palestinian people, their unity, and their rights. I'm Eduardo Artes, and this is Black and White.
Hoy estamos con Pablo Jofre.
Today I talk to Pablo Jofre Leal. He's a journalist and international analyst. You're very welcome to Black and White.
Thank you very much, Eduardo.
Pablo, ¿cómo se puede entender?
How do you explain the repressive military measures of Israeli regime in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin? I mean, both internal factors in Israel and international ones.
Interno de Israel como internacional.
Firstly, Israeli incursions are not sporadic. The presence of the Israeli occupying army is permanent in the occupied West Bank. They don't enter the Palestinian territories from what they call Israel. They stay in Palestinian territories. There are 650,000 Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli army protects them. Therefore, what happens in Jenin, Nablus, and Ramallah, or in any other Palestinian city, is a permanent and intensified aggression against Palestinians. It doesn't matter how many Israeli soldiers attack these areas. Since the beginning of 2023, Israeli forces have killed over 200 Palestinians. There are 14 toddlers among them. There is an increase in number of counteractions of Palestinian movements and organizations that go beyond the classic ones, like the Islamic Jihad and Hamas. The Palestinian resistance movements are frustrated and outraged by Israeli aggressions. The Palestinian youth are upset with the Palestinian National Authority that does not take political matters into account and does not take necessary measures for right of self-determination of the Palestinian people. This entity has security coordination with Israeli regime. This bond has resulted in the arrest of Palestinian resistance movement's members. This is an internal concept. The division of many Palestinian movements and organizations also paves the path for Israeli regime to exert more pressure. Inside the Zionist regime, the most extremist cabinet within an extremist society headed by Netanyahu tries to strengthen an absolutely authoritarian regime which is not democratic at all. It is a racist state called Israel that has a basic law. Netanyahu pushes for the judicial reforms to continue to cover his crimes with impunity. Implementation of judicial reforms creates numerous problems. Implementation of judicial reforms also creates Netanyahu's control over the judiciary and intensifies the colonization of the West Bank with the aim of Judaization and Zionization. At the regional level, the resistance front has an active role from the western border of Iran to the Mediterranean. For instance, Hashd al-Sha'bi in Iraq, Syrian National Army, Hezbollah resistance movement in Lebanon, resistance movements in Palestine and Ansarullah in Yemen. This resistance front is generating tensions in Israeli affairs. In this situation, the resistance movement will carry out determined actions against the Israeli regime.
Many commentators believe that it is a turning point in Israel, although Israel has never had basis for its existence. Israel is going down fighting and increases repression against Palestinians in the face of internal and international conflicts.
Frente a contradicciones internas e internacionales.
Sí, yo te diría que el régimen nacional sionista.
Well, Israel was established in 1948, and there is no history of such regime before that. What they say are myths and falsehoods. Since its creation, I believe that the Israeli Zionist regime has tried to prolong its existence with the extermination of the Palestinian people, theft of Palestinian resources, and theft of Palestinian territories. The Israeli regime has also intensified tensions with countries in West Asia. So in a turning point like this, undoubtedly, the Israeli war machine tries to kill more Palestinians. Israel continues breeding terror, demolishing houses, building walls, destroying Palestinian crops, preventing the return of Palestinian refugees, and building more settlements. Regimes usually tend to slow down and think a little about what they're doing to try to control the situation when they're under political and military pressure. But Israel intensifies attacks against Palestinians because the United States, France, Germany, UK, European Union, and NATO are complicit in Israeli war crimes. So Israel continues assassinating more Palestinians because it enjoys impunity. Israel knows that the UN is not going to do anything beyond denouncing, and the European Union only issues classic declarations. The United Nations Charter is not applied. Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter, which is a dead letter, states that international collective actions must be taken against those regimes that are a threat to peace. Nations must block that regime, sanction it, embargo it, impose no-fly zones, and deploy peacekeeping force in that area. But nothing happens in case of Israel.
Crear zonas de exclusión aérea, poner fuerzas de interposición, eso no se hace.
Pablo, let's have a short break, and then we will continue our talk immediately. European Israeli settlers say that they are experiencing a very complex situation regarding the identity. Many of them have dual citizenship. They have the passport of their original country and the Israeli one. Physically, they feel that they are in France, Germany, the U.S., and other European countries. They also witness the crisis in Europe, in the U.S., and at the same time observe a multipolar world that is developing. These points have internal political consequences. It's a very good opportunity for Palestinians who fight for their self-determination and national liberation.
Por su autodeterminación y por su liberación nacional.
It's a very interesting point, because the Israeli society is in a state of chaos. The Israeli society does not belong to this region. They're not Semites. The only Semites in this conflict are the Palestinians and not the Israelis. Israelis are Europeans in general, Belarusians, Moldovans, French, English, Germans, Russians, Ukrainians, and recently Americans, Chileans and Argentinians. There are more than 10,000 Chileans in the occupied Palestinian territories. There are 65,000 Americans, and 10% of the settlers in the occupied West Bank are originally Americans. It'll be necessary to do a very deep archaeology to discover the origins of Semites. Therefore, this identity is absolutely mythological. Israeli historians themselves, for example, Shlomo Sand, speaks of the invention of Israel. The Israeli entity was established in 1948 and has been trying to trace its birth back to 2,500 years ago, using myth such as a temple and rain. They're part of the general history of humanity. There are empires, civilization, and culture during human history. There's also a dichotomy in case of Israel. Many Israelis of European or American origin seek this security in their places of birth. The Israeli regime, and mainly Netanyahu, seek to convince settlers who aren't politically aware to believe in Zionist myth. The conflict in Ukraine serves this regime to accept Ukrainian and Russian Jews. There are more than a million Russians in the occupied Palestinian territories since the time of the former Soviet Union. These issues bring about important contradictions. That's why thousands of Israelis take to the streets to oppose judicial reforms, which strengthen the most ultra-extremist sectors. I have to mention that this society does not protest in favor of Palestinians, but for its representative democratic interests. These are two different things.
Se moviliza por su interés democrático representativo.
That's right. These are internal conflicts within the Zionist regime.
That's absolutely correct. They protest against the judicial reform because it gives more powers to the most ultra-Orthodox, most ultra-nationalist, and the most terrorist groups within a terrorist society.
What can Netanyahu do in this situation? Don't you think that the recent aggression in the occupied West Bank, which has been the biggest incursion in the last 20 years, was carried out to cover the Israeli internal conflict and resolve it through hatred towards the Palestinian people? They want to exterminate the Palestinian people. Undoubtedly, their dream will never come true.
That's definitely correct. They don't want to solve the internal problems and seek the solutions in external players, who are Palestinian people in this case. Netanyahu unifies the Israeli society against the same enemy. So there's a Zionist myth, which states that they shall do everything to avoid a new Holocaust. This is an absolutely irrational and despicable claim. They create ghettos, concentration camps, exterminate the Palestinian population, carry out targeted killings, and steal Palestinian lands. The Israelis attack Palestinians under the pretext of preventing criminal acts against themselves. So there are major inconsistencies.
Hay contradicciones muy potentes.
Pablo, the young Palestinians are looking for their own semi-autonomous ways to fight for self-determination. Traditional organizations such as the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, the Palestinian Resistance Movement, Hamas, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, lately have taken a very firm position and call for armed resistance. In this context, what do you think about the Palestinian National Authority's position regarding the Palestinian cause?
There's a fundamental difference. The movements and organizations that you mentioned are more traditional ones that have never stopped fighting the Israeli regime. They've never been part of the Palestinian National Authority organization. In 2006, there was a conflict between Hamas and Fatah, which resulted in political division between Hamas, which ruled Gaza, and the Palestinian National Authority, which ruled the West Bank with the support of Israel and the U.S. in that moment. Since Mahmoud Abbas assumed his leadership, he began to push back the acts of resistance. He sometimes makes a statement, and that's all. All those resistance movements are fighting the Zionist regime. There are also new young Palestinians in those movements. The Palestinian population is essentially young. Therefore, the Lion's Den and resistance movements that seem autonomous are actually formed with young individuals who are frustrated by seeing no advance in the fight for self-determination. Palestinian Islamic Jihad, the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine have their own ways and plans. We've seen Palestinian Islamic Jihad's operations in Jenin and the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas's retaliatory strikes in Gaza. There are operations that are based on resistance movements, objective, and the self-determination of the Palestinian people. This is what they expect from the Palestinian National Authority.
I think that this time the Zionist regime does not have a chance. The Iranian president was recently in Damascus, and one of the main issues on the table was the liberation of the Golan Heights. In this general context, how do you see the future of the resistance movements and the Palestinian struggle for liberation?
I hope that the future of Zionism will be as dark as possible, because it means the liberation of Palestine and other nations in the region.
The world shouldn't forget that Biden cited a bone-deep bond between the U.S. and Israel.
Joe Biden, in his speech before the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, said, "I'm a Zionist, but I'm not a Jew."
And he also said that if there were not an Israel, we'd have to invent one.
Zionism is so close to imperialism. They don't have many differences. They're both expansionist, totalitarian, exterminators, and genocidal. They have many similarities. Not only do they get along very well, but they have a deep relationship. 14 of the 20 ministers of the U.S. government are Zionists. There are 14 Zionist ministers in very important positions, such as national security and homeland security. That is actually a Zionist cabinet. I think that the disappearance of Zionist regime is the best thing that could happen in the West Asia and the world. What I'm mentioning has nothing to do with neither anti-Semitism or anti-Judaism. I hope that Zionism will disappear, just like National Socialism. The National Socialism came to full stop in European countries based on established rules. We have to do the same thing in the world. Zionism must be eradicated. We must avoid its development in our countries. Zionism means falsification, extremism, assassination, and corruption. In Chile, Zionism has maintained a very close relationship with the government since the dictatorship until today. They have been cooperating in terms of weapons, logistical services, and national satellite communication system. Zionism is involved in economic, technological, and espionage issues. They also have cooperation in terms of underground aquifers. Zionism is spreading like cancer in Chile, which is very dangerous for our country. They are active in Argentina, Colombia, Honduras, and Guatemala. We shall take necessary measures regarding their presence in West Asia because they're killing Palestinians every day. We shall eliminate Zionism as a political ideology. Jews who want to stay in Palestine can easily leave there. Palestinians have always welcomed their decision. Zionism, Zionists, and extremists are the real problems.
Se pueden quedar, y siempre lo han dicho así los palestinos. El problema es el sionismo. Son los sionistas, son los extremistas.
Eso es, Pablo. Bueno, te agradezco tu presencia.
I thank you very much for participating in our program, Black and White. Surely the Palestinian people will be victorious, because history can't be erased by the will of imperialism. Thank you very much for attending the program.
Ya, y será hasta otro momento.
Thank you very much, Eduardo, for the invitation.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson: the purpose of the Prophet's mission. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As everybody can clearly understand from the Holy Quran and the traditions of Islam, an important purpose behind the mission of the prophets, especially the last Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, is to guide people to the reformation of their morality and the purification of their souls. That is to say, to make them grow through commands and rules which guarantee their felicity and happiness in this world and the world to come, which is the hereafter, and also to protect them against wickedness, psychological difficulties, and ill-treatment. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Most High, says in the Holy Quran, chapter 2, verse number 151, "Even as we have sent to you an apostle from among yourselves who recites to you our communications and purifies you and teaches you the book and the wisdom and teaches you that which you did not know." If you notice in this verse of the Quran, Allah details the responsibility of the Prophet, the purpose of the Prophet's mission. So brothers and sisters, we know that Prophet, you know, he has come to educate us, to grow us in all dimensions, especially our spiritual growth. So with this, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to discuss some of the things that the Prophet guarantees. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are discussing the purpose of the Prophet's mission, and we detailed in the light of a holy verse of the Holy Quran what the mission of the Prophet is. The Prophet guarantees people's felicity and happiness in this world and the world to come. Remember this, it is not just confined to the hereafter. The program that the Prophet provides for humanity is to make their this world successful as well. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in chapter 3 of the Holy Quran, verse number 164 says, "Certainly, Allah conferred a benefit upon the believers when He raised an apostle from among themselves, reciting to them His communications and purifying them and teaching them the book and wisdom. Surely, before that they are in manifest error." Brothers and sisters, before the Holy Prophet enabled mankind to understand the heights that they can achieve, the perfection that they can achieve, people were living the age of ignorance, jahala. Prophet brought humanity out of the age of ignorance through, number one, reciting the words and commands of Allah. Number two, purifying them. Number three, teaching them the book and wisdom. So we know now what the purpose, the general purpose of all the prophets of Allah was, especially our beloved Prophet, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
U.S. families are undergoing a third straight year of falling incomes, but American politicians think taxpayers' money is better spent elsewhere. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted, as Uncle Sam continues to pump billions of dollars into Kiev's flagging fight against Russia and provide tempting handouts to illegal migrants, why is the average American worker forced to live paycheck to paycheck? Here's a question that most people have considered at least once in their lives and probably a lot recently. How much annual income would you need to feel financially secure? For the average American, the magic number comes out to be $233,000 a year, according to a survey by Bankrate. To bring the 99% back down to earth, the U.S. Census Bureau released some sobering data that dashed those elusive six-digit dreams. Inflation-adjusted median household income fell to $74,580 in 2022, a 2.3% decline from 2021 average of $76,330. This marks the third straight annual decrease since the COVID-19 pandemic began in 2020, taking a wrecking ball to the heart of the economy. The bad news doesn't end there for U.S. consumers who are now struggling with the consequences of a foreign conflict in a distant land and a wide-open border. Those factors have prompted the cost of living to surge higher than it has in over four decades amid runaway inflation. In June 2022, the year-over-year inflation rate, as measured by the Consumer Price Index, hit a jaw-dropping 9.1%, the highest it's been since the administration of former President Ronald Reagan. A significant reason for the increase in inflation happened on March 3, 2022, when President Joe Biden signed an executive order to ban the import of Russian oil, liquefied natural gas, and coal to the U.S. This decision has had disastrous results for the local economy. Since Biden's inauguration, the cost of gasoline alone had jumped at one point by 100%. As of September 27th, the average price of regular gas was $3.832 per gallon, according to the AAA, while gas prices were an average of $2.3 per gallon when Biden entered office, forcing just about everything else to skyrocket, including the number of poor people. The poverty rate in the U.S. exploded last year, the first increase in 13 years, according to the Census Bureau. In 2022, the rate was 12.4%, up 4.6 percentage points from 2021, according to the Supplemental Poverty Measure, SPM, a method for tallying government welfare programs and tax credits designed to assist low-income families. Meanwhile, the expectations index, determined by consumers' short-term outlook for income, business, and labor market conditions, sunk to 73.7 in September. That follows a drop to 83.3 in August. The worrisome part is that an expectations index below 80 generally indicates an impending recession. An economic tragedy is already quietly happening for millions of American consumers who are now living paycheck to paycheck precariously and who have been forced to use the payment method of last resort to make ends meet, the almighty credit card with its exorbitant interest fees. On this score, the U.S. economy has broken yet another record, although not in a way that could be considered something to cheer about. U.S. credit card debt rose by $45 billion to $1.3 trillion in the second quarter from the first quarter, a 4.6% quarterly increase, and that was what Street reported. The Street added, it's the first time in U.S. history that household credit card balances topped $1 trillion mark as the number of credit card accounts expanded by 5.48 million to 578.35 million in the quarter. When consumer debt suddenly equals the amount the U.S. spends on its military-industrial complex, you know there is a problem. Clearly, the U.S. has some serious domestic issues that need to be resolved, but instead, it would rather fund a totally senseless proxy war against Russia. Washington has given Ukraine close to $100 billion in aid, with more in the pipeline since Moscow launched its special operation in February 2022. The cash, however, has not only been used to fund Ukraine's military. Billions of dollars have subsidized participants of the Ukrainian economy like farmers and small business owners, market players whose counterparts in the U.S. desperately need help too. A recent study conducted by the Council on Foreign Relations shows that more than $30 billion, around 40% of total U.S. aid to Ukraine as of July 31st, has been financial or humanitarian assistance that is not directly connected to military support. Military funding comes out to around $50 billion. As if that were not enough, the Biden administration continues to welcome illegal migrants at a price that is more than what is being spent fighting a proxy war against Russia in Ukraine. Yes, you read that right. The annual cost of providing care for the millions of illegal migrants entering the U.S. is $150.7 billion. According to the Fiscal Burden of Illegal Immigration on United States Taxpayers Fair, in August, U.S. Border Patrol recorded 232,972 migrant encounters along the southwestern border, a jump from 183,494 in July. The number of crossings for September is predicted to be higher than the previous month. So, here we have two concurrent events, a disastrous military conflict in Ukraine and a leaky U.S. border, that are sucking away precious funds from the American taxpayer. It's important to note that the king's ransom that is being handed over to support these deranged democratic agendas will never be returned, not in American lifetime. Instead, it will just be added to the unsustainable U.S. national debt load, which is currently at $33 trillion, according to the U.S. debt clock. That is an astronomical sum of money that future generations and the current generation of the United States will someday be forced to deal with, and probably sooner rather than later. What American citizen could possibly believe that any of this government funding has been a good investment for the American people? Well, they are representatives in Washington, D.C. for one. In May, conservative U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham, during a meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in Kiev, pronounced joyfully that the Russians are dying and aid to Ukraine is the best money we've ever spent. Aside from discounting the changes and chances that such an investment could have towards unleashing the Third World War, Graham never thought for a second that such funds could have gone far at rebuilding America's crumbling infrastructure, like that non-existent wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. It would have been a wonderful work program for the U.S. economy. In short, it's just another day in the discombobulated American empire, which, much like its ancient Roman precursor, could learn the lesson of overexpansion and overspending in the most brutal way imaginable, with its total and complete dissolution.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Zawid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws about the prayer based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Zawid, is it permissible to turn one's face to the right or to the left side during the prayer?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. There is no doubt that one should be facing the Qibla one while praying, while offering your wajib prayer. And it's not permissible to deviate from the Qibla deliberately. Okay, if something happens and you deviate from the Qibla unintentionally, that will not affect your prayer. But if you do it intentionally, it will definitely impact your prayer. When it comes to the salam of the prayer, because when you are doing the salam of the prayer, the last greetings in the end of the prayer, of course we see that Sunni Muslims, they turn their heads to the right and to the left, and that's not permissible according to Shia Islam, according to the Shia teachings, because you are still in the prayer, you are doing and performing your prayer, you have no right to turn your face completely to the right side while you are doing taslim, you are doing giving salam, and to the left side. Of course, what is recommended is to look at the right shoulder and to the left shoulder. By not turning your head towards either side, okay? You just have the right to just move around your eyes. Move your eyes to the right side and to the left side. Because when you are reciting salam, you are actually giving salam to, for example, the malaik or the angels who are either on your right side or your left side. And of course, you are not allowed to turn your face, okay? Mm-hmm. Usually we see that some Shia Muslims, I do see, they also, you know, they turn their heads right to the right side and to the left side while giving Allahu Akbar, reciting the last takbir. Of course, the takbir at the end is not
part of the prayer.
It is, you know,
recommended part.
It's recommended. So in that case, the prayer is not affected. Mm-hmm. But again, it's useless to turn your face to the right and to the left side, you know. Some people do it out of habit.
Mm-hmm.
They do not have proper understanding of the reason why they should look towards the right and to the left side. So I want to say it once again that while saying assalamu alayka ayyuhan nabi wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, assalamu alayna wa ala ibadillah salihin, and assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, we should not turn our faces towards the right and to the left. Rather, we can look. It's recommended to look to the right side and to the left side by moving our eyeballs, okay? Mm-hmm. And that's allowed. That's nice. Recommended.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en.
In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws about the prayer based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, Sheikh Javed, is it permissible to change one's intention? You said in one of the earlier programs about the intention as being one of the elemental part or basic foundation of the prayer. It's actually the first rukn of the prayer, right?
Yes.
So it's that important. But if one is to change one's intention from, for example, ghadha prayer to the adha prayers, right? Or from the recommended prayer to the obligatory prayer, is it permissible for that person to do so?
Of course, it is permissible to change your niyyah from qadha to adha. You know, you are supposed to perform a prayer which is already incumbent upon you. Now you are at, for example, it's the fajr prayer, and you are already performing a mustahab prayer. You can change your niyyah from qadha to adha. Because what is necessary is to perform the adha prayer. The adha prayers are the prayers which are performed within the prescribed time. Like, you still have got time to perform them. So that's why it's called adha. Adha means within the time, within the prescribed time. Now when it comes to qadha prayers, the qadha prayers are the lapsed prayers, the missed prayers that you must perform at any time, for example, whenever you get the opportunity to perform them, you can perform them. The time is extended. So you can change your niyyah from qadha to adha, but not vice versa. You cannot change your niyyah from adha to qadha. That's absolutely forbidden. And the same is true with mustahab and wajib prayer. You cannot move from wajib to mustahab prayers. Because you're supposed to do the wajib prayer first.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. Sheikh Javed, another relevant question in here is that if a person has not yet offered the morning prayers, and while offering, for example, the noon prayer, he wants to change his intention from adha to qadha, is it permissible for him to do so?
No, it's not permissible. Just like I mentioned earlier, it's not permissible to perform to move or to switch from qadha to adha prayers. If I got you properly.
Yes, from adha to qadha.
From adha to qadha. The thing is that if you are, let's say, if you have the time is extended and you want to perform the qadha prayers, you can perform the qadha prayers first. But if you're already performing the adha prayers,
right,
the prayers which is currently and presently obligatory, and which the time is there, so you cannot switch from adha to qadha, just like the example you gave right now.
I see. Okay. Another question, Sheikh, is that is it permissible for a person to change one's intention from obligatory prayer to another obligatory prayer? For example, from Asr to Zuhr prayers.
Of course, it is permissible, because you have not performed the Zuhr prayer, the midday prayer, and you remember that you have not offered the Zuhr prayer, and now, since the Dhuhr prayer cannot be performed after the Asr prayer, in some cases, of course, then you should change your niyyah from the Asr prayer to the Dhuhr prayer. You should complete and finish the Dhuhr prayer first, and then carry on your prayer, continue with the Asr prayer, the afternoon prayer.
Mm-hmm. What about, you know, both of these prayers have been qadha, I mean, already.
Yeah.
So the person is to perform or to offer both the midday prayer as well as the evening, or which we call it Asr prayer. All right?
Yeah.
And both of them are qadha.
Yeah.
Like the next day, he's going to perform it. Is the order important?
The order is recommended. It's recommended to maintain the order to perform, but it's not wajib, you know, because there are
to perform, for example, the Zuhr prayer first and then the
of course,
Asr prayer.
It's not the order. It's not necessary to maintain the order, but it's recommended to maintain maintain the order. If you happen to offer the Asr prayer and then the Zuhr prayer, there's no problem because these two prayers are two different and independent prayers.
Mm, I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, in which we try to, deal with some of the jurisprudential laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei about the prayer here in this episode. Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Genocide in Gaza. Hundreds more Palestinians are killed after the Israeli military targets a hospital in the besieged enclave. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, deplores Israel's genocide in Gaza, saying the regime should be put on trial over his crimes. Also in the headlines, Ismail Haniyeh, political bureau chief of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, calls on the international community to condemn and to take actions against Israel's deadly bombing of a hospital in Gaza.